from the Mutual Broadcasting System. This is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk, and today I'm going to talk about some big issues. I'm going to talk about the Ukraine-Russia reality check, as I like to call it. I'm going to talk about what's become the Gaza gamble, the ceasefire slash peace agreement process, or the risk entailed in that process. And then I'm going to talk about something which I find really interesting, which is a three-court panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals just reversed the decision on federalization of the Oregon National Guard. And I'm going to touch on that just a little bit, because that's a big issue. And it's becoming a bigger issue because of where the Guard may be deployed elsewhere. Now they're talking about the Guard going into San Francisco. So anyway, let me get going and talk about this first thing. Now, you may have heard that, you know, President Trump was talking about, after meeting with President Zelensky on Friday, October 17th, that he was going to, or actually before meeting with Zelensky on October 17th, that he was going to meet Putin, President Putin of Russia, in Budapest, Hungary. And there was a lot of press on that, and that this was going to be another big meeting, kind of like Alaska was, and certainly a lot of speculation on whatever would come of it, because not much came from Alaska. And then this week on Tuesday, it was like, just kidding, not doing that. And so not going there. And part of the reason was because on Monday, Foreign Minister Lavrov of Russia had turned around and he was talking to Rubio, and there was supposed to be a pre-meeting or a pre-summit meeting between the foreign ministers that just wasn't going anywhere. And Lavrov and I would say Putin as well have just, they simply retreated right back into their maximalist demands. They want all the oblasts that they claim, all the provinces that they claim in Ukraine, which would leave Russia poised to then swoop in at a future date and do another invasion of Ukraine to try and take the entire country and seize it for Russia. And so that's, it's a pretty serious situation. There wasn't really anywhere to go. So the White House said the meeting was postponed. Of course, this was after they had had the talk about the meeting was after there had been a two-hour phone call between Putin and Trump. And then simply nothing's come of it. All right. Basically, as you may recall, Trump went to Alaska and met with Putin in August, and walked away without really any concessions I could identify from Russia. And he said going in there that if he didn't get a ceasefire agreement, that the meeting wasn't successful. He walked out without a ceasefire agreement, but called the meeting successful, saying they were going to go for a full peace agreement. And after the meeting with Zelensky on Friday, interestingly enough, he walked away saying you're going to try for another ceasefire. So kind of went right back to the pre-August meeting or pre-Alaska meeting demands for an immediate ceasefire on the current line of control. But it doesn't look like Russia is really inclined to do any of that. And, you know, from what I can tell, you know, Putin got what he wanted, which was Putin's thing was to stop Tomahawk missiles from going to Ukraine. And certainly President Trump had talked about that. Look, the Tomahawk missiles make a big difference. If they were to go in there, they have some highly accurate deep strike capabilities. You don't have to give them a lot to make a big impact, if you will, across Russia, particularly European Russia, particularly places close to Moscow, St. Petersburg, but also looking at those absolutely critical but very vulnerable oil refineries that they have. And along with other critical infrastructure. And so he didn't want to see that happen. And so Putin kind of got what he wanted, which was that's Tomahawks are off the table. Those are pretty much walking out of that meeting Friday. It was very clear that there were no Tomahawks are going to be handed over. And whatever was said about that, sending Tomahawks was, I don't know what you want to call it, but it just had, it wasn't substantive and nothing ever came of it. All right. The meeting with Zelensky on Friday was cordial, certainly in public. There was a very public meeting. And, but, you know, Putin got his goal, which was he's not only delayed, I think he's taken the Tomahawk missile thing off the table for the foreseeable future. And reports were that in the meeting, as soon as they closed the doors, that President Trump and maybe some others had, or President Trump or some others in his administration had kind of gone back to, well, if Ukraine can pull out the entire Donbass and give all that territory away in Donetsk Oblast that it holds, then maybe there could be a ceasefire or a peace agreement or something like that. And of course, for Ukraine, and certainly for all the European allies, that is completely unacceptable. And it's really not a peace agreement. It's just a delaying agreement, allowing Russia to build up forces in a better geographical position to launch another invasion to try and take Kyiv and try to take the rest of Ukraine at some point in the future. And Russia and Putin have never backed away from their maximalist goal of eventually taking over Ukraine. That's why they went into Ukraine, was to take over Ukraine. That has not changed. You know, these little things with just the five oblasts or whatever, it's very interesting. But actually, if you look, if you want to go back, it was a heck of a lot more than five oblasts that they were claiming. There are claims, even if we were to stick with the lower number of territorial claims that Russia's made within Ukraine, it's more than the oblasts that they're actually operating in now. They've actually made some far larger claims across the board. So you just kind of have to keep that in mind. They haven't walked away from that. It appears that basically there's nothing moving forward on any sort of ceasefire or peace agreement, nothing of substance. But I will say something on the other side. As you may have heard me say before, the Flamingo cruise missile, not getting the Tomahawks, but the Ukrainians have developed a cruise missile called the Flamingo. It carries a warhead about the same size as the what the Tomahawk carries. It's got a similar range to what the Tomahawk has. It's reportedly a very accurate cruise missile. And so it, in many ways, it really is kind of an equivalent to the Tomahawk, but there is a big difference. It costs much less. Now, October's production rate for these missiles is estimated by the end of the month to be somewhere between 270 and 290, I think, or somewhere in that ballpark of the total number of missiles. We'll see if they actually make that number, but that is a pretty substantial number. At first, they were making about two or three of these things a day. Now they're reportedly making about seven of these things a day, and it's estimated that sometime in the first quarter, maybe by February or something, it's going to be substantially higher than that, which is a lot of these Flamingo cruise missiles that can reach out and touch pretty much all of European Russia and can go east of the Urals into what's generally referred to as the Asian part of Russia, can reach well into the Central Asian portions of Russia and hit the vast majority of those 38 major oil refineries that Russia has. And so there's some rather interesting possibilities that we've done. Now, it costs, to build a Tomahawk cruise missile, costs somewhere about $1.5 to $2 million. They're pretty expensive, each missile. Very capable. You may recall we used those to hit two of the three Iranian nuclear sites, during the 12-day war back in June. But they're very, very capable missiles, and we've been using them a lot. However, the Flamingos probably cost somewhere between, it's estimated, $500,000 apiece, maybe up to $1 million, but it looks like that higher number was based on the lower production rates. And with the higher production rates, the actual cost, the real cost per missile drops, so it'd probably be closer to that $500,000 per missile, which is another way of saying that you can buy about three Flamingos for the price of one Tomahawk. And the Flamingos are produced in the Ukraine. And hence, whether the U.S. sends or sells Tomahawks or sends Tomahawks to Ukraine or not, the Ukrainians can still produce these Flamingo cruise missiles that can largely replicate the same mission profile that the Tomahawk cruise missiles were doing, and they're producing them at a higher rate. The number I heard was being talked about with Tomahawks was maybe a couple of hundred, and I would say in the time that I've heard the discussion on Tomahawk missiles, Ukraine has produced a couple of hundred plus of the Flamingo cruise missiles. So they've been doing a lot of stuff, and certainly with these longer range cruise missiles, these Flamingos, along with the longer range drones that Ukraine has, they're able to hit a lot of sites well within Russia, basically taking out their critical infrastructure, potentially taking out the places where they build their ballistic missiles, where they build their drones, where they launch their fighter bombers from, along with taking out the thing that fuels, if you will, pays for the war, which is oil and gas, and particularly taking out those gas or those oil refineries and making those long gas lines in Moscow and St. Petersburg that much longer. And so there's a lot of things that they can do on their own. Russia's faltering offensive hasn't really achieved much. They've had a few small gains on the battlefield, but then Ukraine's been doing a counteroffensive, and they've had some rather notable gains on the battlefield too. So it's not really sure that who's going where. And you may recall back in August, I was talking about this big buildup of forces, that there was 100,000 to 150,000 forces that were supposed to be part of a big fall offensive. Well, as far as I could tell, they built up those forces. As far as I know, they just aren't making much progress on the battlefield. In fact, there's been some very small, somewhat anecdotal, but some very significant losses of forces on the battlefield. In fact, just recently, there was a report that came over that Russian troops were actually surrendering to a robot, a ground drone, out of fear. A Ukrainian ground drone robot was essentially taking Russian prisoners of war. So that gives you an idea of where the Russian troops' confidence, morale, and everything else is, that they're surrendering to robots on the battlefield, which I don't know if that's a first case. I recall the during the Desert Storm, I think the Iraqis were trying to surrender to a drone, a fixed-wing drone with a propeller on the back, and it's kind of an odd thing. At least it was interpreted they were trying to surrender, but this is the first case I know where a robot or a ground drone actually took troops prisoner and marched them back to friendly lines or Ukrainian lines. Now, let's talk about Gaza. The Gaza ceasefire faces a lot of challenges. There's been accusations, particularly out of coming from, accusations certainly out of Gaza against the IDF. But really, when you look at the violations that have been going on, the violations have been primarily coming from the Gaza side, from Hamas, after this big ceremony where they met in Sharm el-Sheikh and they signed this agreement, and 20 plus world leaders came in and pledged themselves this peace thing, and there was going to be humanitarian aid flowing in and all these other issues. And as literally as the ceasefire started, they did get the live hostages back, but then they started dithering on returning the remains of the 28 deceased hostages that they were supposed to return. And that has been a very, very slow process. Of those 28, I think they've returned 10 so far. That may be increasing, maybe one a day, so to speak. But it's really taking a long, long time. As you can imagine, the families and others are very frustrated with this. They see that as essentially a violation issue. And Israel has responded. They have curtailed some of the delivery of aid trucks going in there, not the least of which is the difficulty of aid getting actually to the Gazans, and the fact that those aid trucks have been, they'll have people jumping on the back and throwing off boxes and all sorts of problems with that. There's been ongoing violence on the streets. Some of that, Hamas has literally been going out there and basically reasserting itself, taking people into custody whom they believe were collaborating with the Israelis, or people that they just didn't like, that they thought maybe posed a threat, rivals, belonged to a rival organization or something, and just putting them on their knees and executing them, basically summary executions. And that has caused a lot of global outrage as well. And so this is really, it has really put a damper on the success of this. Now, Vice President Vance just went over to Israel. And interestingly, he turned around and said, I'm not putting a date or a deadline on when the hostage remains have to be returned. Although the deadline for that, that came out of that agreement, has come and passed. So I know he could say that, but the agreement itself actually has it written out when those hostage remains are supposed to come back, and that has not occurred. So I just kind of put that as a little note, little asterisk, if you will. All right. There's indications that Israeli forces, Palestinian forces, have had confrontations with casualties. There have been airstrikes on Hamas facilities, and two Israeli Defense Force soldiers were killed by Hamas. And so this is that even though it's in a quote ceasefire, it's not a completely cold ceasefire, if you will. Although with that quick response, I think that you saw kind of what you saw up in southern Lebanon with Hezbollah, the speed and the size of the response was such that Hamas kind of got the point. And that's the same thing they had to do with Hezbollah up there. When Hezbollah would violate the ceasefire in southern Lebanon, Israel would respond with what some would say was overwhelming force, but definitely significant force, enough that Hezbollah would immediately get the point that, you know, shooting at Israeli troops or doing something like that will be met with something that they just don't want to deal with. And so that would be an incentive for them not to violate the ceasefire. And I think that's the same case here. The next steps in this, first, they got to get through phase one completely. I don't think they've really done that. They're still trying to get phase one stipulations done. The next steps in phase two are very daunting. They are supposed to disarm Hamas and the groups aligned with Hamas, like PFLP and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And we'll see if that happens. Right now, Hamas has been hedging on that. They have been trying to make exceptions for certain weapons that they could carry. They've been doing all sorts of things, and that's a big issue, is how to disarm Hamas, and whether even the rank and file and small units of Hamas in Gaza, even if the Doha group agrees to it, will they actually do that? Will they comply with that agreement on the ground in Gaza? That's a big question. It's a question for the Israeli Defense Forces, and Netanyahu has said that it might be up to Israel to actually disarm Hamas. All right. The hope was that there would be a Arab and Muslim-led stabilization force that would go in there, international force, and they would actually deal with the disarming of Hamas. But under the current situation, it's not clear if that's going to happen. That gets into, can they get the stabilization force mobilized, and can they get them in there to do what they want to do? And then, of course, they have to establish an interim government. You know, whether this peace board led by President Trump and involving Tony Blair is going to take place. And then the authority that they will have and all these other challenges, it's pretty big. So it's a long way of saying there's a distinct possibility that this whole discussion could start to break down. And there's a possibility they could go back to war. And certainly the IDF looks like they're preparing for exactly that. And we'll see if the big, you know, declaration of peace in Sharm el-Sheikh may have been a little premature. Obviously, if the whole thing breaks down, I mean, it's great to get a ceasefire. It's great to get more aid in there. But if the whole thing breaks down and it goes right back into the same war that we had before, then I don't know what really came of that other than the best of intentions. Now, last thing I want to talk about is a decision that just came out October 20th by a three-court panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. In a 2-3 ruling, they allowed the federal government to federalize and potentially deploy about 200 members of the Oregon National Guard. I understand that they have not been deployed yet, and I understand there's another decision that has to be reached before they will be deployed, but that has been put out. This decision obviously came after there was a federal court judge that put a stay on that federalization and deployment of those troops, and then California and joined in, and the judge actually said federalized National Guard troops from any state can't go to Portland to do this, and it was to protect federal property and maybe protect federal personnel doing immigration enforcement operations. Anyway, that appears to have been largely overturned by this decision, although there is still something else that the court has to look at more closely that to get a full deployment, if you will, in there. Now, this would have deployed the troops under Title 10 status. Title 10 and Title 32 are two federal statuses that the troops would can be federalized in. Title 10 is they are completely federal. There is no ambiguity in that. So basically what the court was saying is, yes, the president can federalize National Guard troops under Title 10. I don't really find that particularly controversial myself, that the federal government can do that. And the idea that the National Guard, it's the term National Guard, is a state asset that the feds are allowed to borrow is completely backwards. They are a part of the federal military system. They are a federally recognized military units, troops, etc., that when they are not in federal status, when they are not supporting a federal mission, that the governor can activate using state funding, state active duty, to do things. But outside of that, they get trained to federal standards. Title 32, which is another part of the funding, which pays for folks that do the training and pays for folks getting the training, is a federal status, although it doesn't change the entire chain of command that goes up through the state military headquarters. But that is a federal, that is actually federal funding. So anyway, the courts came back and said, look, yeah, you can federalize these troops. Now they're also looking at, is the exigent situation that they need to go to South Portland? Is that still a big enough requirement for it to do it? That's more of a subjective decision. I find it interesting that the courts are still deciding that. I don't know that the courts have a big role in deciding that, but anyway, that's what was brought before them. And so they're looking at that part as well. And it's an ongoing debate. Now, recall that federalized military, whether regular military or federalized National Guard, have been used in a variety of different roles over the many years. They were used to protect the U.S. mail runs back in, the 1920s. If you look in the 1950s and 1960s, under Eisenhower, John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, they not only federalized National Guard or used federal troops, but they also declared the Insurrection Act in order to enforce federal law and federal court decisions involving civil rights and integration of the schools. And I'm sure those Southern governors were just as vociferously opposed to that as some of the governors may be vociferously opposed to what's happening today with using it to support immigration enforcement. But I just want to point out that there is truly a bipartisan history of using federalized troops, to include federalized National Guard troops, for in support of domestic things. And there have been the Insurrection Act imposed in the past. So it's not unprecedented that we're seeing this stuff. And if San Francisco refuses to allow federal law enforcement to do immigration enforcement, or blocks or obstructs that purpose in San Francisco, I don't see it's a big legal or conceptual stretch that that could be seen in the same glasses, if you will, that the what was happening in Arkansas and Alabama was happening way back when, with trying to not comply with federal law and federal court decisions involving civil rights. And so I could see where that would be something that they may say, yep, that's a violation of the Insurrection Act. So anyway, that's a lot of stuff. Thanks for listening to Strat. Thanks for taking the time to do this. You can also hear this on stratpodcast.com. You can also go to my YouTube channel, Hal Kiemper TV, where you can see a lot of my media hits, if you will. And by hits, I mean interviews. And also, you can also go to my corporate website, www.gripsa.com, for global risk intelligence planning. Thanks for listening, and I hope you listen to the next one.